last time.
And you're listening to The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. Now, my guest today is one of our finest singer-songwriters. She was born in the Caribbean before moving to Birmingham, aged just 7, and at 14, she started writing her own songs and taught herself to play guitar. And even then, her focus, her absolute focus, was being the very best songwriter she could possibly be. And she became quite a remarkable one, emerging from her folk-influenced 70s to become a globally recognised artist whose music encompasses blues and funk and jazz and soul, but she remains distinctly herself. As you'll hear, despite Grammy and Brit nominations, a CBE and a career that's now lasted over 50 years, she remains a step aside from music stardom. The only thing that really matters is the song. I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Joan Armatrading. And you just heard Down to Zero, featured on Joan's 1976 self-titled album, an album that contains possibly her best-known song, Love and Affection. But more on that track later. So I started off by asking Joan, as I do with all my guests, when was the very first time she was aware of music?
The first thing that I was aware of more than music was comedy, because I love comedy. So that was what I was really interested in, and I wrote jokes as well, and I used to write funny little stories and things like that. Then my mom bought a piano. She thought it was a great piece of furniture, put it in the front room. But the piece of music that I heard first, that I was aware of live music, if you like, was when my dad played a song called Blue Moon on the guitar. And he played very jazzy chords to this song. And it was lovely. It was really, really nice how he played it. And I loved the jazziness of it. I loved the tempo that he played it at. I love the dynamics of it. My mom was very much into country music, bluegrass music and stuff like that. So they, I think, helped to shape this thing of me liking different genres of music. So yeah, that's my first real kind of recollection of music that I was really aware of and interested in. Never taught me to play the guitar. He would hide that guitar from me so that I wouldn't touch it, but he did teach me how to tune it. Because he wouldn't let me play it, I wanted to play the guitar. And so I saw a guitar in the pawn shop. It cost £3. I said, Mum, can I have that? She said, well, if they'll swap it for these two prams, you can have it. And that's how I got my first guitar, which I still have. And when I got the guitar, my dad showed me how to tune it with this weird little tune that you kind of play on each string, that I've never seen anybody else tune a guitar like that, and I still tune my guitar like that. And probably from them because of them liking, you know, jazz and country, and I got the sense of lots of different things. And so I write lots of different styles.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, right there at the start, the eclecticism and the kind of those beautiful chords, it was there already, it was formed at the beginning.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about the first piece of music that you owned. Was there a record, a single that you got out that was
first piece
yours?
Of music? I was never into buying albums and people's music, but I remember at school you'd open somebody's desk and there'd be a picture of whichever pop star was there. I never got into that, but somebody called Gracie Fields, people probably won't remember Gracie Fields at this moment, but she had a song and it was a B-side. I think it was the B-side of Little Donkey, if I'm not mistaken, but it was the B-side of something, and it was called Carefree Heart. And I absolutely loved it because it said, beware, beware the carefree heart. He's up to upset your apple cart with his... I can't even whistle properly. But it's those words, and then the whistle at the end was just fantastic. So I loved that song.
Be cruel for some whistling fool to let in a glimmer of hope. Beware, beware the carefree heart. He's apt to upset your apple cart with his. Pay no heed to him if you do. You'll be
So that's
a pretty good lyric, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great lyric. And so I loved that. And I loved her kind of quirky, even though I don't think she would have been incredibly old, but she had an older sounding voice, you know, kind of quivery sort of voice. I loved the whole of everything about that. But yeah, I didn't really buy records. And I didn't ask my parents to buy them for me either.
That's interesting. It was more about trying to find your own way into it rather than trying to copy somebody else.
Yeah, I always say, and I'm absolutely sure of this, this is what I was born to do. I was born to write songs.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that I didn't go about trying to learn everybody else's songs. All I was interested in was doing my own thing. I absolutely appreciate other people and admire other people. And I think, my goodness, how clever are you that you wrote that lyric, that melody, you got that arrangement, you have this sound. How clever is that? That's just impossible to get that from one person. So I have that for people. But while I'm doing that, I'm not thinking, yeah, that's, I want to be like them. I don't tend to think like that because I'm quite happy with who I am. So I'm quite happy to just be me. And I can, I'm happy to just appreciate them because I don't want to take that away. That's too good to take it away and say, I want to be that. You need to let them have that. That's great.
So I'm from Birmingham. And obviously, you know, that's a place that is woven into your past. And I kind of wondered, because I'm really proud of the Brummy attitude. I just wondered if you think that the kind of the Midlands characteristics, because I could feel it in the way that you've run your career, because Brummies do not like showing off too much.
No.
There's always the raised eyebrow of like, you know, we take the mickey a little bit. We're proud as people, but we don't really, there's not a lot of pretense. Yeah. And I just wondered if you think that coming from the Midlands kind of affected the way that you are and you've run your career?
I would say it's a combination of that and, of course, my parents.
Yeah.
Because my parents were very down-to-earth people. But I love Birmingham. You know, when I was growing up, Birmingham especially when it was the old Bullring, was not the most attractive place. And you would think
it was not.
You would think that people coming from somewhere that wasn't so attractive would be unattractive themselves. But the personality of the people from Birmingham was so great. And the generosity and the kind of welcoming thing. That's what I loved about Birmingham. I still love about Birmingham.
And the first, tell me about the first gig you went to.
The first gig I went to was to see, well, I think it was to see Georgie Fame, but I don't actually remember seeing Georgie Fame because the first person I saw was Chris Farlow.
Right.
So that's the gig I remember as my first gig. And I think on the bill were lots of other people, but I don't remember the lots of other people. I only remember Chris Farlow. I think I'd probably be, I don't know, 16, do you think? Maybe 17.
You don't know what's going on. You've been away for far too long. You can't come back. I think you are still mine. You're out of touch, my baby. My poor fashion, baby. I said, baby, baby. Giving up your social world. You can't come back. Be the first in line. Oh yeah. You're obsolete, my baby. My poor unfaithful baby. I said,
it's that thing, isn't it? If you love music, and like you were, you're writing music or like finding your way into songwriting, but then seeing it performed, being in a room with musicians, it's different, isn't it? It's a different feeling.
It's a great feeling, but it didn't make me think, oh yeah, I want to be up on the stage. I've never really had that kind of a...
Yeah.
That's never been my thing, being, you know, famous and all that stuff. I wasn't into that. What I was into was writing just the best song anybody could ever write in the world. And people saying, oh yeah, that was written by Joan Omer Trading. And somebody saying, oh, what does she look like? Because they wouldn't know me. That was my dream.
That's the goal.
That was my thing. It'd be great to just be a songwriter. Everybody knows my songs and they're singing them all over the place, but they don't really know who I am. So when I saw Chris Farlow, I didn't think, yeah, that's it. I want to be up there. That didn't really... And he must have had some kind of impression on me because I don't remember Georgie Fame, even though he was the headliner, but I remember him. But Georgie Fame has played on my records. I mean, he's a great musician, great singer as well, great guy as well, all of the greats.
Let's do your first album, which was Whatever's For Us, which is 1972. Now, yeah. What I like about that record is that normally your first record should be done in like some dingy rubbish studio because no one's got any money, and it should be produced by some bloke who was the tape ops tea boy at 4 a.m. and you went off to like with Gus Dudgeon, famous for like obviously Elton John at
the Honky Chateau
in France, and sort of that's a pretty luxurious place to be doing album number one, let's be honest. That's not normal.
Yes, but the only problem with that was they just had a fire, so it wasn't looking its absolute best when we went there. But it was really nice still. Yeah, I always think, how lucky am I that Gus Dudgeon was my first producer? Because he was, Gus is no longer with us, but he was one of the nicest people in the world. And I can say that without fear of contradiction. I mean, he was one of the nicest people. I loved him because he appreciated me, that I knew what I wanted, that I knew what I was doing. He didn't try and say, well, I'm the big cheese, you know, this is the first time you're in a studio, let me tell you what to do. And, you know, when I go into a studio, the song is written. I'm not going into a studio hoping that everybody else will help the song to become the song. I go in with a verse, a chorus, a middle eight, a solo. So the song you hear is the song I've written. Gus never tried to say, well, actually, you need to put a chorus here or the... I'd put the chorus there. The chorus is where I want it to be.
That's where it's going to go.
That's where the chorus is. That's where everything is. So.
If it was going to be somewhere else, I would have put it somewhere else.
Yeah. But what was great about Gus was he, and I can say the same thing about Glyn Johns, he could appreciate where I was and what I was doing and have the input that needed to be there so that I could appreciate his talent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll always be so, so happy that Gus was my first producer. And we remained friends right up until his death. I mean, he was just... And, of course, you know, he was great at sounds. He was great at getting a good atmosphere in the studios. Great at introducing me to lots of different musicians of very high caliber. So you mentioned Elton John, and David Johnson was actually played on my very first album. He played guitar. His is the only album that I've ever played on. I played piano on his album. Charlie's introduced me to really good musicians. As I say, having a great atmosphere in the studio, just kind of got everything right for me, you know, just everything that you needed to happen in the way that it should be to make everything just work and be just the best experience. How cool is that? That the best experience is your very first time of being in the studio. It's your best experience. It's fantastic. You can't ask for more than that, except you can have the same thing with your third album, because I had the same thing with Glyn. So, you know, so lucky to have been able to do that twice.
So talking about knowing exactly how you wanted things to be and having a very clear idea of the song structures and how you want things to sound, and being a relatively new artist still, did you come up against pressure in the industry? Because normally young artists, young female artists in the 70s, I mean, it's not like it was an easy path. It wasn't like it was offered on a plate. You know, did you find it difficult to have your voice heard and have your opinions listened to outside the studio? Obviously, the studio was a great environment. Was it difficult?
I don't know, because I was just doing my own thing.
Right.
So if it was there, I wasn't taking any notice of it. It's very important to know what you want. Mm. And it's very important to know who you are. It is for me, was then when I was young. I've only known me as this. I don't know me as anything else. That's kind of the answer, really. One of the first things they said to me was, you've got to change your name. You can't be called Joan Armour Trading, because nobody's going to remember Armour Trading. So we've got to find another name.
What did they suggest?
I have no idea, because I wasn't listening.
Okay, so you mentioned working with Glyn Johns, but the 76 Joan Armour Trading album, that was, it's kind of one of the first ones that really starts to make waves for you. I mean, Glyn said it's one of the best albums he's been associated with ever. What can you remember from that record? Because I often feel like there's some albums, and when you imagine how they're being put together, you're just thinking, it's just working. Everything just works. Everything is interlocking. Those are the right songs at the right time. The performers are right. The musicians are right. Because it's such a beautifully natural... I'm sure it wasn't effortless, but it sounds effortless, that record.
I'm kind of stuttering because I have to go back to what I said before. When I go into the studio, I go in with the song.
Yeah.
So because the song is there, you're not spending ages trying to work out what the song should be. I wouldn't go into a studio with well, I've got an idea for a riff. Let me play you the riff and then we'll see what we can get from. I can't do that. I've got to go in with Love and Affection or, you know, Call Me Names or whatever I'm going in with. That's the song I'm going in with. So having...
The work is done beforehand in some ways.
Absolutely. But having said that, if you're going to work with great musicians, you do have to allow the musicians to be their talent. So even when I'm going in with a song, the song, if I'm playing with a keyboard player, I need that keyboard player to say, my name is Georgie Fame. You know, this is me. Not my name is Georgie Fame, but now tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be Joan Armour Trading. I need him to be, I need him to be Georgie Fame. So you're going to get the personality of the musicians coming through. You need that. Otherwise, don't have them. You know, don't have them not be able to show their talent. And that's the beauty of working with musicians, is you get to see how talented people are. And I could say to a keyboard player, okay, go and just play me middle C, hit that note. You say that to 10 different keyboard players, you'll get 10 different sounds.
Yeah.
You know, some will hit it bang on, some will kind of tap it a couple of times, some will tap it and twiddle, you know. You're going to get different things from different people, and the personality of the person is going to come through, and that's what you want, and that's what helps to make the songs become what it is. You've still got to know that everybody who contributes to that record is a part of that record, whether it's Glyn, whether it's me, whether it's the bass player, the keyboard player, the drummer, doesn't matter who it is, the tea person who came in and said, excuse me, would you like a cup of tea? Everybody's a part of it, you know? That's great. That's why you work with people. I mean, over the years, I've kind of done everything myself. But that's just because I can and I enjoy it. But it doesn't mean to say I'm not appreciating people's talent still.
When Love and Affection came out, can you remember people's reaction to it?
I can remember the record company saying, when I asked them for that to be the single, I can remember them saying, yeah, remember, Joan, you asked for it.
I am not in love, but I'm open to persuasion. East or west, where's the best for romancing? With a friend, I can smile, but with a lover, I could hold my head back and really laugh, really laugh. Thank you. You took me dancing across the floor, cheek to cheek, but with a lover, I could really move, really move. I could really dance, really dance, really dance, really dance. I could really move, really move, really move, really move. Now if I can feel the sun in the rain on my face, why can't I feel love? Really love, really love, really love, really love, really love, 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 love. Now I got I may need my home, but I should just stick to those that I have got. With friends, I still feel so insecure. Little darling, I believe you could help me a lot. Just take my hand and lead me where you will. No conversation, no. Once more with the feeling, give me love, give me love, give me love. Love.
I remember when we were making that record, we were all really, really happy about it. We all felt that we'd made a really good record, you know. Again, just like Gus in the studio, Glyn gets a great atmosphere. By then I'm even better at communicating directly with the musicians, which I did with Gus, but I tended with Gus to communicate through Gus more rather than directly to people. I'd say, well, I want the keyboard player to do this or the drummer to do that. Of course, I would talk to the musicians, but I tended to kind of go to Gus first and say, well, I need this to happen. Whereas with Glyn, even if I said something to Glyn, I would say it to the musicians directly. And we all had a really good, very friendly, very, like, we're all working to the same ends feel about it. And I, unless I'm completely mistaken and I don't remember correctly, I feel that we felt at the end of the record that we'd made just a great record. You know that's what I
love. And it is a great record, no doubt about it. That was the brilliant Love and Affection from Joan Armatrading's self-titled third album, released in 1976, produced by Glyn Johns. And when Tom York from Radiohead was a guest on this show, that was one of the songs that he remembered as having a huge impact on him as a kid. And in more trivia, that really deep backing vocal on that song is by Clark Peters, who you might know as Lester from The Wire, the TV series. So this is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest today is Joan Armatrading. Coming up, we'll be talking more about what it's like to be quote-unquote famous and how Joan approaches songwriting, and also what it's like to be something of a pioneer in the music world. That's all coming up after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Catherine Cracknell. The Port of Dover says work's been continuing around the clock to help holidaymakers and lorries get across the channel after lengthy waits over the past 2 days. Queues there are expected to go down to about an hour this afternoon. The port's chief executive thanked travellers and local residents for their understanding during what he described as a challenging period. People using Eurotunnel to travel to France have been warned to expect long delays at Folkestone, but the company's Director of Public Affairs, John Keefe, expects the situation to improve.
In the next couple of days, it gets lower in volumes. Today is about 7,000 cars going through our terminal. Monday, it's 6,000-ish. And then the middle of the week, it's much calmer. But of course, it rebuilds. Thursday, Friday, Saturday will be at similar levels to this weekend, slightly lower, but it'll be very busy.
A man believed to be in his 50s has been stabbed to death in a pub in West London. Officers were called to the venue in West Ealing just before midnight last night. Russia's admitted it carried out yesterday's missile attack on Ukraine's port of Odessa just a day after signing a deal to unblock shipments of grain through the Black Sea. Moscow said it hit a military ship. Ukraine's declined to say whether it was military or civilian. The board of Cricket Scotland has resigned with immediate effect ahead of the release of an independent review of racism in the sport. The report to be published tomorrow is expected to find institutional racism in the Scottish game. Our sports correspondent Gavin Ramjuan says the independent investigations passed a number of allegations to Police Scotland.
That review was conducted after allegations were made by Scotland's all-time leading wicket-taker Majid Haque, who claimed that Cricket Scotland, the sports governing body in the country, was institutionally racist. He said he was treated differently from his teammates because of the colour of his skin, and that was at the back end of last year. Cricket Scotland have said that it is truly sorry to anyone who has been racially abused.
Fires have broken out in several regions of Greece, threatening tourist resorts and animals in a national park. Hundreds of people have been moved from their homes because of the blaze on the island of Lesbos. Kate Moss has revealed how a photo shoot as a teenager opened her eyes to the dangers of the fashion industry. The model told Desert Island Discs she was asked to pose topless during a photo shoot.
I had a horrible experience for a bra catalogue, and I was only 15 probably, and he said, take your bra off, and I could feel there was something wrong, so I got my stuff and I ran away. I think it sharpened my instincts. I can kind of tell a wrong'un a mile away.
Plants have been removed from a parish council display in Dorset after a local gardener realised they were cannabis. Six were taken out. West Parley Council said the plants were given to the police, adding that the display may have been tampered with. That's Six Music News. The next update's 2:30.
BBC Radio. Six Music.
Show some emotion. Put expression in your eyes. Light up if you're feeling happy. But if it's bad, then let those tears roll down. Keep the laugh out of it.
Show Some Emotion, the title track from Joan Armatrading's fourth album, released in 1977. If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time. And Joan Armatrading is my guest this week. Show Some Emotion was Joan's first top 10 album. And with those kind of record sales, what you get is famous, for want of a better word.
I'm not famous, really.
Oh, you are, Joan.
Am I?
Of course you are. And, you know, I don't mean that as a bad thing. People know who you are for your songs. I think that counts as famous.
Oh, okay, right.
Please, no, I don't want to be famous. But, yeah, but, like, all of a sudden it's like people act differently around you because they've maybe seen you on a TV show, or people have heard you on the radio or read an interview or seen a picture. You know, the world's different if people know who you are before you meet them.
It is a different thing. I mean, you know, I remember being on a plane once and somebody saying to me, oh, Joan, you're, because I was going to America, they said, oh, Joan, you're going to America and you're going to do a tour and I hear you did this and this and this. And my thing was, when they were saying that, I was thinking, well, what's your name? Who are you? Why are you telling me all this stuff? And I don't even know, I don't even know who you are. So that's different. But, you know, I kind of try to just keep my head down, really. I don't get involved. I love people coming to and saying hello to me, and I absolutely love people saying that my songs mean a lot to them and they've used them for their first dance, or they've named a child after my song, or they've communicated with each other with my songs as love letters. I mean, I've had all of that, and that is just the best. That's what you want as a songwriter.
Mm.
The other stuff, I'm not particularly, I don't know, I don't really take much notice of it, you know. I kind of keep my head down, really.
But I think if you like, I mean, especially as we're moving into the 80s and Me and Myself I, and like it's happening in America, which is a whole different level of kind of success, can you avoid the attention? Can you still quietly slip off stage and avoid the hoo-ha? You can. You can still do that.
Yes, absolutely, because that's not what I'm doing. What I'm doing is writing songs and getting them to the people for them to absolutely love and say she's the best songwriter in the world. That's my job. That's the job. That's my aim. My aim isn't to be walking down the street, oh, there's Joan Armatrading. That's fine. I don't. But, you know, love the songs, great. So if my typical me, quietly get to the gig, go in, do the sound check, go back to the dressing room, nice and quiet, come on stage, do the show, love it, love the audience, wonderful. Look, they're singing that song, they'll look back to me, wonderful. Finish that, go back to my dressing room, go to the hotel. That's me.
That's it.
That's done. You know, I'm not going to go and look for something else after that. I mean, I'm just nice and quiet.
I think that's a probably reasonably good strategy for keeping sane, generally, mm-hmm. I think. If your job's going to be standing on stage and people looking at you.
Yeah.
You've got some of those songs that people just love. And I think you spoke quite recently about how Drop the Pilot has kind of really kind of over the past 5 or 6 years grown into something that people have.
Oh, not, I mean, ever since it's been out, people have loved that song.
Oh, yeah,
and I've loved that song. But over the last kind of few years, I've come to absolutely love that song. That's really what I'm talking about. I've come to just think, God, what a great song. I did a live stream 2021, and I just couldn't wait to play that song.
Physical.
I don't know, it's just suddenly taken on this thing for me where it's so up and positive and makes you feel good. It makes you feel like dancing, like singing, like playing. It's great.
It's interesting. So your relationship with songs can change over the years.
Yes.
Something, it alters. Do you feel that happening a lot with other songs when you're like, oh, I obviously love that, because I wouldn't have recorded it if I didn't, but now I love it for a different reason?
Yeah, if I'm on tour and I'm playing the set, certain songs, even on different nights, will become the song that I'm looking forward to playing the most. So, like, right. There's a song of mine called Kissing and a Hugging, which has been my favourite song to play forever. Drop the Pilots and I have taken that over, but that's been my favourite song to play forever.
You know I talked of loving, and you talked of love to me. We sat down under a bus shelter and talked of other things, but bit by bit by bit by bit it came round again. How much in love are we? It was a fine thing. We were. So much love to give. It was the right thing. We were alone under the stars, getting in the mood, kissing under the big bright shiny star that lights up the sky.
And then every night I would look forward to playing Love and Affection, every night without fail, because I know that the audience are going to love it, and that's the song everybody knows that's in the room. So that's always a treat. But sometimes there'll be a song, like a song of mine called Dark Truth, and I'll think, that's so sweet, and it's very short, and I really want to play that. And then sometimes you'll play a song, like there's another song of mine called Blessed, which is kind of Dark Truthy. It's just very, very sweet. And I remember the first time I played that on stage, and at the end of it, the audience kind of went, aww. Because it's that kind of a song, you know. It's just all the songs that I'm playing, it's because I'm very happy to play them. I'm playing Love and Affection all the time, Me, Myself, Drop the Pilot, Willow, Rosie, Cool Blue. I'm playing all those songs all the time, no problem, because I love playing them. But if I play one that I think, didn't enjoy that so much, don't play it.
Yeah. If you look at, I think it was 95, you got the Ivor Novello for the Outstanding Song Collection. And that's, for a start, that's the Songwriters Award.
Yeah,
that's the one, isn't it?
The
especially
one.
For someone who just wanted to be a songwriter, who didn't even necessarily want to be on stage. And after all that time, that must have felt hugely special to be recognised by your peers, but also for the songs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't think of a songwriter who wouldn't say that was a special thing, because it is,
yeah.
It is about writing songs. It is from the Academy that deals with people who write songs. The people who are voting for you are people who write songs. So the whole thing is centered right around this thing that you hold precious. So it does feel very special. And it was wonderful to get that award. And also wonderful to later on become a fellow of the Ivors. I mean, again, very special. It's not been handed to everybody.
How has your approach to songwriting changed from when you started to do it? Is it still the sit down in a certain way with a certain instrument, with the blank canvas in your mind, and just start, the things percolate for a while before you sit down and first put the hands on the fretboard? How is it different now?
It's all of those, and it's always been all of those. So right. You might start with, I feel like writing, because that's a feeling, and I don't know how to explain that, but you have a thing where I've got to write. I've just got to go and write. That's how it
you
goes.
Have to do
you
it.
Have,
you have to do
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You've just got to go and do it. And then I'll go for ages, 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 where I don't have that feeling, so I don't write, and it doesn't bother me, because I know it'll happen again. And so I'll go to the piano, because that's where I'm being led, or I might go to the guitar. I might start off with lyrics first. I might start off with the melody first. I might start off with the riff first. Very rarely is it, as you said, a blank canvas, because there's usually right. something going on in my head that says, this is what you're going to write about. So there's usually a reason for writing. And I write from observation. I tend to write from looking at people. Somebody will say something, do something, I'll see something. And that'll spark something off in me that makes me want to write that song. I don't necessarily go straight away and write it, but I'll store it. Sometimes I'll write it down, the idea. I remember seeing Eminem, and he's had this great big pile of notes and scribbles, and I mean, huge. And I suppose what's supposed to happen is he will go back to that when he was ready to write and look through that. And I'd love to ask him, do you really? Because I know when I write things down, I don't go back to many of the things that I've written down. It's usually from the thing that's in my head, the things that stayed with me. And when I'm ready to write, that thing will pop back in and I'll think, oh, yeah, I saw that and that's what I want to write about. And then whatever the song tells you, and it might sound stupid, but the song will tell you what it wants to be. It'll tell you the tempo it wants to be, the genre it wants to be, the key it wants to be. I've written enough songs in the wrong key just because that's the key the song needs to be in.
So that's interesting the way you say that, like the song will tell you what it is.
Yeah, the song tells me what the song needs to be. And that's how I've been all the time. And then in 2007, I decided that I wanted to write a blues album, a rock album and a jazz album.
Yeah.
And when I did the blues album, which was called Into the Blues, and went straight to number one in the Billboard's blues charts, I had to really kind of rein myself in, because I'm used to writing whatever comes into my head. You know, okay, there's a jazz song followed by a reggae song followed by a pop song. But I had to say, Joan, you're writing a blues album. Stick to that.
You can't have more than three chords. Stop it.
That's
stop it.
My baby likes this music good and loud, with words coming straight from the heart. Man, woman, or child can tell this story, just as long as it's a soulful start. All the better to make you glad, 'cause your life is taking a different path. At the same time wondering how you can get on a train to this town. Bless the blues. Hey, yeah. Are you a mannish boy? Just like the mighty mud. Blues are here to make you glad, but your life is taking a different path. At the same time wondering how you can get on the train.
So that was kind of interesting for me. But after that, then I went back to writing whatever I wanted to write. I just kind of go along with whatever feels right at the time. It's kind of stood me in good stead till now.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously just speaking to you, I don't think anything that happened to your records after you finished them, you know, you want people to engage with them, but it doesn't seem that the fuss and the something being quote unquote like a hit doesn't really bother you as long as people are enjoying the music. But it was kind of cool that Consequences, which was only, you know, last year,
yeah,
went top 10, which was like, you know, the highest chart for a while. And even though I don't imagine you spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff, but a little bit you must have been like, yeah, that's nice.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I want the songs to be hit songs. I want them to do well. I want them to get into the charts. But I'm writing to make the song good. That's the first thing. I'm writing to make the song good. And then I want it to be in the charts. I mean, I don't want to write a song that only my friend and my mother likes. That's not being a successful songwriter. I need lots of people to like what I write. And that's one of the ways to measure it, is to have hits. So, of course, you want things to be successful. But at the same time, you don't want success just for the sake of success. You don't want success and people say, well, it was successful, but it wasn't really good.
Yeah.
You want them to say it's good and successful.
Are you comfortable when people talk about you as a bit of a pioneer, as a bit of a hero? Because as a songwriter, as a lyricist, as a performer, as a female artist coming through from the 70s, as a black artist coming through from the 70s, people really respect that journey that you've done. And there is that idea of like, you know, you did something that other people hadn't done before.
Yes, and I'll acknowledge that because that is the case. When I started, there wasn't, to my knowledge, a black woman writing the songs, singing the songs and being how I was. That just didn't exist. That was not a plan of mine. I didn't say, oh, there's that gap, let me fill it. That didn't come into it. Again, all I was doing was just being myself. I was just writing the songs I wanted to write. I could play the guitar really well, so that was unusual. It was very, very strong, definite, good guitar playing. So, you know, that's just what that was. And there's always going to be somebody who does something for the first time. That's just how that is. Of course, there are people who will look for the gap and are able to fill it. Of course there are. There'll be people like that. But a lot of the times, as great as the Beatles are, and everybody acknowledges that, they didn't plan for this domination. They didn't say, oh, we're going to be dominant for the next 300 years. They didn't plan that. They were four guys just trying to be pop stars and make the best music that they could and last for as long as they could and just enjoy it, and obviously had a sense that they were good. I'm not saying that they didn't know that, but they wouldn't have been able to plan this and put it on paper and say, we started in 1962 or whenever it was they started, and in 2022, we'll still be just as big. You can't plan that. You can't plan that. I mean, when I started, somebody said to me, oh, you have a 5-year career. I didn't listen to them. I didn't know I would have a 50-year career and more, but I didn't kind of plan that either. I just did what I was doing and people went along with it. Thank you, people.
How is it seeing the lyrics down in this new book? Because it's different on the page, isn't it, than it is in front of a microphone?
Well, you have to remember that I've written them, so I've seen them before. So I kind of know what they look like, but they're written with melody. And when you're writing lyrics with melody, you write them in a certain way. If you're going to write them without melody, the structure would be slightly different. You'd either use more words or you'd do something that's different. You'd do something that allows you to read it without thinking, where's the melody of that? But a lot of the lyrics that are in the book, you can read without the melody and get what you're supposed to get from them. And I'm very proud of that. It's great. I love the idea of the book. It's really good. And I hope people enjoy reading the lyrics.
And the last question is, what's the last song that we should play? What should it be?
I'd either finish the interview with Already There, which is from that album that we mentioned that came out last year, which was top 10.
Why that song? Why should we finish on that?
I love that song. I love the idea of it, because what it's saying is, it's another way of saying love at first sight. And when the person finally says to somebody, I love you, the other person says, well, actually, I was already there. I already loved you. I was just waiting for you to say you love me. So I like it.
Then that's the song we shall finish the show on. Thank you so much, Joan. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You just told me you love me for the very first time. And it feels like I'm flying. And the sky is all mine. I'm floating on air. Let me tell you my secret. I've never said it before. While you were falling in love, I was already there. I was already there. Already there and so in love with you. I was already there. I was already there, but I was biding my time. From the very first touch, I wanted you more than I needed to breathe. The feeling I got was more. To notice me, but I noticed you, and you took my heart. I was already there. I was already there. Already there, and so in love with you. I was already there. I was already there. Already there, and so in love with you. I was already there. When you came to me crying from your recent heartache, I would die just a little, but I knew not to fade. In your lonely existence, I could feel your heart change. You were falling in love, but I was already there. I was already there. Already there, and so in love with you. I was already there. To
there from Joan Armatrading's latest album, Consequences, which was released in 2021. The final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Joan Armatrading. And that is the end of this week's show. Head to BBC Sounds to catch up with more first times from the archive, from the likes of Franz Ferdinand, Alex Kapranos, Licky Lee, Janelle Monáe, Kelis, and many more. We'll be back next Sunday with another first time guest. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
I was on.